Well, as most of you know, the G20 Seoul Summit is coming up very soon in November, and it isn't just going to be a cakewalk, as we've seen with some of the preparations underway. The summit is going to bring a lot of challenges as well as opportunities to Korea. So in this part of the G20 Special Summit series, we're going to be talking about the summit with Mr. Barry Caron. He is a senior fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Victoria in Canada. Professor Caron, welcome to the evening show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Now, we've been talking a lot about the G20 summit, not only on our program, but also all over Korean media in the weeks leading up to this meeting. And I'm wondering about some of the expectations of this summit, you know, whether they are too high given the complexity of the agenda and also the fact that it takes place in just a couple days. What do you think about the expectations for this summit currently?
Well, there's no question that the expectations are really too high given the many constraints on any host, any G20 president. You know, the topics are very complex. We've got the challenges for Seoul. We've got to defuse or resolve the currency dispute. There might be other crises that erupt just a day or two before. Something might happen with respect to European debt or the North Korean military. There's expectations that the Seoul summit will carry the stimulus austerity debate forward. We have to push forward the resolution of governance reform of the World Bank and the IMF. So the topics are complex. The preparation time clearly is too short. There was less than 5 months to prepare for after the Toronto summit for the meeting next month. The Seoul summit's less than two full days. The agenda's packed with a whole bunch of commitments from past G20 summits, and yet there's great pressure from many sources to add other issues like climate change or, you know, reform of the UN Security Council. Other constraints on the host is the fact of life is that the leaders of all these countries don't have the technical expertise to negotiate solutions themselves, and they're not backed up by a professional secretariat with an institutional memory. Another fact of life is that several leaders have difficult political situations at home, so they're going to have to focus on selfish national interests rather than the global good. Other realities are that the G20 doesn't have compliance measures to enforce decisions. You know, it's an informal grouping. And the fact of life is that G20 countries have very different views in the context of, you know, the troubled economic conditions we're in. I think the biggest challenge in terms of constraints is the loss of urgency. You know, there's the phrase that what's gone now is the fellowship of the lifeboat, where people saw themselves in the same lifeboat during the acute phase of the financial crisis, you know, at the first couple of meetings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can see kind of the evolution of the meetings. Many critics have said that as time has gone by, the meetings have essentially just become a place where the participants come to agree to disagree and don't really come up with any solutions or changes to their policies in order to move things forward.
Well, that's what the critics say. I think the fact is that the existence of the meetings lead to conclusions and decisions that wouldn't otherwise have been made. I think last week the meeting of finance ministers and central bank governors that took place in Korea, mm-hmm. Just the last couple of days, have actually come up with some really useful things with respect to the reform of the International Monetary Fund. That might not have happened if the G20 didn't exist. You know, the International Monetary Fund was not going to reform itself.
As far as you listed before that, you know, a number of issues with the G20 summit. I think the one on a lot of people's minds right now, at least the one getting a lot of press, is the currency debate. You know, with all the different countries' agendas that are on the table regarding this, everyone seems to have a different outlook on what the best solution is. How do you think that's going to play out during that G20 meeting this year?
Well, I think they'll agree that in general terms, they're not going to come up with numerical targets like the Americans had suggested. They wanted to have a numerical target for what current account deficits could be relative to the size of the country's economy. I don't know if you've seen the communique that came out of the meeting last week of finance ministers and central bank governors. That seemed to be, consensus. The headlines in the New York Times today were sort of favorable. That G20 leaders pledged new steps on trade, and they listed the kinds of things that they agreed to do with respect to the IMF.
Mm-hmm.
The sub-headline in the American press was the IMF gets a larger watchdog role over member policies. So there are certainly skeptics. You know, the Financial Times is pretty skeptical, but other newspapers are reporting it as really quite a constructive outcome.
And what role do you think Korea played in setting the agenda, or at least getting the momentum going to talk about these issues? I mean, how much does a host country play into that?
Well, the host country is the critical umpire. I think any success in this extraordinarily challenging time is due to the skill of the Korean officials and the Korean ministers working on this stuff. There's a general impression that they've done an excellent job in consultation, and it's been quite exemplary, really, in terms of ensuring that the voices of people who aren't at the table are heard.
Now, as far as issues of the G20 itself, it's only been... This group has only been meeting like this for a few years now. You know, you talked about the fact that there isn't a permanent secretariat. What exactly does that mean, that it doesn't have a permanent secretariat?
Well, what it means is that whenever the chairmanship shifts, then the people who are responsible for preparing the agenda and the options that are on the table, the people who are responsible for managing relations with the non-member countries or dealing with international organizations, and the people who have to follow up and monitor the implementation of commitments, those people are not in the harness for any length of time other than the chairmanship of their country. So, the difficulty will be on November 13th, the French will take over the G20 chairmanship, and they have to start from scratch in terms of preparing the agenda and options for the next meeting, in terms of consultation and outreach with other countries and international organizations, and that's not a good idea. I think it would be a lot better if we had some continuity, some institutional memory. And the proposal that some people have made is that, well, there's something called a troika, the past, current, and future chairs, the senior official, the personal representative of the leader, called the Sherpa, from each of the three countries. You could have a three-headed secretariat rather than have some independent official who is permanent, because the critical thing is that... you can't have a bureaucratic organization running this thing. The leaders have to control it. The leaders have to be committed to it. So the way to do it is to just have secondments and have the Sherpas or the leaders for personal representatives serve as co-secretaries general. All the Korean officials who have worked so well designing and setting up this meeting and running the consultations, they should be seconded and work with the French and the Mexicans for the next 2 years. And I think if people rotated through, then you'd have, that would be the way to square the circle. You could get the institutional memory and the expertise, the continuity, without bureaucratization and without ceding control to some, independent bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the thinking behind this rotating secretariat system? What are the benefits of doing something like that?
Well, the benefits would be that if you had people involved for 3 years, then you'd get some continuity, you'd get some understanding of what the, you know, the original commitments were. You'd get more follow-up in terms of monitoring the implementation of commitments. And most important, you would spread the burden of consultation. There's a tremendous amount of consultation that has to take place. Each host really should be having a very serious bilateral dialogue with each of the other members, let alone all of the non-member countries or international organizations. And just the sheer logistic weight of having to do all those consultations, it's a very onerous task.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a lot simpler if you had a larger group of officials who were skilled and trusted by their leaders. And, you know, one proposal is to have a secretariat consisting of secondments. Sarkozy's on record as saying he thinks there should be a permanent secretariat of at least 20 people, President Sarkozy of France.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sekong Il has seconded the idea. So one hope I have is that the Seoul summit will announce one form or another of a secretariat. They just have to take care that it doesn't appear to be some sort of independent bureaucratic operation that's not under the control of the leaders.
Right. The entire national police force, thousands of officers are going to be patrolling the streets and keeping things secure for the summit. One of the biggest malls here, the COEX Mall, is actually mostly going to be shut down because it's so close to the location where the meetings are going to be taking place. I'm wondering what you think about these kinds of security measures in light of what happened in Toronto and the backlash that had there.
Well, unfortunately, it's a sign of the times. I remember 15 years ago, there was a G8 meeting in Halifax. Canada was the host of the G8 in 1995, and there were virtually no barriers. There were no security, really wasn't hardly visible at all, and the leaders, after the meeting, actually walked down some of the major thoroughfares in full sight of half a dozen feet away from the general population who were sort of lined up there. That couldn't happen today. I don't know if it's a result of 9/11 or general security situations changed dramatically over the last decade. And I don't think the host has much choice other than to, put the meeting on an isolated island somewhere or an aircraft carrier. If you're going to have it in a city, you're going to need large numbers of police and security barriers. And I think the residents just have to accept the fact that that's a day you're not going to be, or 2 days that you're not going to be going to the mall.
Yeah. As far as, you've mentioned a lot of the things that you think need to change within the G20 for it to become, more efficient, more have more impact around the world. I'd like to know what you think you would like to see out of this upcoming meeting here in Seoul. What do you think would be a satisfactory outcome of this particular conference?
What you have to look at is that what these meetings do, rather than just come up with a communique saying what our decisions are about a couple of the issues on today's agenda, is that they basically set the future work agenda for all kinds of officials all over the world and for all kinds of international organizations. What happens at these meetings is that the leaders invite their own ministers to give them reports in the future, or they call for a report from international organizations to be prepared for a future G20 meeting. And what happens is that the whole international policymaking apparatus can be galvanized into action. So there's a whole series of opportunities that Korea has to to basically shape the research agenda and the policy debates for the next 2, 3, 4 years by commissioning work at international organizations, by establishing working groups of officials from the G20 countries, and there are existing working groups. They can expand the mandates of those working groups. So I think what you want to look at in terms of assessing the success of the meeting is not just, you know, what's said about the currency debate or what's said about rebalancing, but you know, my hope would be that there'd be they'd commission the WTO to do some to come up with some specifics for future meetings. They could ask the WTO to set up an expert group to name and shame, you know, with respect to protectionist measures. They can call for an annual G20 trade ministers meeting. They can ask in the energy or climate change area, they can commission all kinds of work at the International Energy Agency or at the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change to develop options for them on future R&D or for future monitoring systems, you know, with respect to carbon dioxide. They can, there's a whole series of remits or terms of reference that they can give to working groups. And I think that's what you want to look at. To what extent has Korea shaped the future research agenda?
Well, Professor Caron, thank you so much for joining us tonight on the evening show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Barry Caron is a senior fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation. He's also an adjunct professor of public administration at the University of Victoria in Canada. He was talking to us about the upcoming G20 Seoul Summit.